top Hamas commander was killed in an explosion today in Beirut. News reports from Lebanon say it was an Israeli drone strike that killed him.
Hezbollah, that is Hamas's more powerful ally and part of the governing structure in Lebanon, has already said there will be a retaliation.
I'm Carolyn Beeler. Why Russia keeps firing salvos of missiles and drones at Ukrainian cities.
They're so cheap to build and use, and if they are eating up Ukraine's valuable defense interceptors, they're playing an important role, even though they aren't actually hitting too many Ukrainian targets.
And a huge earthquake hits western Japan. It's a country that's well prepared for just this kind of disaster.
Japan is a shining light for the rest of the world about how to prepare for earthquakes.
Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler, in for Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thanks for joining us as we all launch into this new year. We begin today in the Middle East and the war between Israel and Hamas that began almost 3 months ago. There was heavy fighting in the southern Gaza city of Khan Yunis, even as Israel announced the withdrawal of thousands of its troops. The Israeli government is facing ongoing pressure from its allies to do more to protect Palestinian civilians in a military campaign that has devastated the territory. More than 22,000 people have been killed, according to Palestinian officials in Gaza. And around 90% of the enclave's population has now been forced from their homes. Meanwhile, Israel's Supreme Court has handed down a landmark decision striking down the government's planned judicial reforms. This sparked a year of major protests in Israel. To discuss this all further, we're joined by reporter Noga Tarnopolsky in Jerusalem. Noga, I want to start with the High Court's decision. What did it rule on that controversial judicial overhaul matter?
Hi, Carolyn. What the Supreme Court ruled in what is probably the most dramatic decision in Israel's 75 years of history is that the parliament cannot remove its ability to engage in judicial review. What this means practically is that the parliament, of course, can enact laws and can enact constitutional laws, but it can't go beyond what is called the reasonableness doctrine. That there are limits to what can reasonably be considered in the national interest. This has immediate effects on many levels in Israel. For example, the minister of police, who is an extremist with previous convictions on terror, wants to name a new police chief. And had the Supreme Court not made this ruling, he could have appointed someone with no experience in policing and simply said, that's my decision, almost by decree. The parliament could pass with a simple majority of 61 out of 120, declared a constitutional law saying that majority Arab parties can't run, that if you don't make a certain kind of declaration of allegiance to Israel, you can't run. The country would have changed its face completely and totally. And the power of the executive would have been unfettered.
And what has the reaction been to the court ruling?
The reaction among many, many people in Israel, a majority, and certainly the judicial community, has been a huge sigh of relief. Among members of Netanyahu's coalition, it's been just a declaration of war. Two people close to Netanyahu in the last 24 hours compared the Supreme Court Chief Justice to Hamas leader Yihya Sinwar, whose number two guy just got assassinated in Beirut. The government has not said that it will refuse to obey this ruling. They're not marching straight into a constitutional crisis, but the threats are really, really rampant.
And so what does this ruling mean for Benjamin Netanyahu and his far-right governing coalition?
Well, it's a massive setback. And what it means is that of the package of 100 or so laws that the government expected last year to pass in about 10 days or so, and simply turn Israel into an authoritarian type state. In the end, 1 year later, they managed to pass only one of those laws, and the Supreme Court just struck it down. Netanyahu himself is currently on trial for corruption. So part of his aims were to protect himself. If there were no longer a reasonableness doctrine in Israel, he could simply appoint new judges and cancel his own trial. So it will also impact him directly, most likely.
So a lot of news out of Israel right now. I want to pivot now to the Israeli government starting to pull some troops out of Gaza. What, if anything, does that signal about this next phase of the war in the Gaza Strip?
I think there's something important to say about it, which is the Israeli army has started to pull thousands of reservists out of Gaza, which means to me that they're cycling into a new phase of this war, which will involve less kind of hand-to-hand, door-to-door urban combat. But the reason I'm saying this is you said the Israeli government. The Israeli government hasn't said a word. So it seems to be that the army is shifting gears and cycling reservists, some of whom have been inside Gaza for more than 2 months, out. But the government that fears a backlash from its right-wing base has not had the wherewithal to say, we're beginning to cycle down this phase of the war. It's caused mass confusion for Israelis, as you can imagine.
Now, prominent members of Israel's government are talking about depopulating the Gaza Strip of Palestinians. Now, this isn't official Israeli policy, but could it actually become official policy?
So the government has very few actual stated policies because Netanyahu is cramped between a sort of realpolitik, what, you know, the state of Israel, President Biden, and the rest of the world is demanding of him, which is at least to state an end goal for this war and to state what he sees as Israel's plans for this area, versus theocrats who say that God spoke to them last night and that all of the entire land from Iraq through Egypt belongs to Israel. So he's really, really stuck.
So to the extent that the government has made any statements about who controls the Gaza Strip after the war is over, what can we gather? What have they said?
So Netanyahu has converted himself into Mr. No. The principal request, American proposition, let's say, is that the Palestinian Authority, which is the internationally recognized Palestinian government, that it be able to take over Gaza again, and that Israel embark on a process leading to a two-state solution, Israel and Palestine side by side. Netanyahu's response to both of these demands has been no. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is arriving here, I think, for the fifth time since the war started in a few days, and this is expected to be the number one topic of conversation.
Lastly, Noga, you mentioned that senior Hamas official who has been killed in an explosion. What does that death mean, do you think, about the possibility of the war with Hamas expanding into a bigger regional conflict, as many people are afraid of?
It could go both ways. I mean, for Israel, this is its first big get of this war. This is Salah al-Aruri, a very important Hamas leader, the number two man in Hamas's military structure. And this also, I think, is a little kind of moment of bucking up the Israeli intelligence services, the military, after the massive failures of October 7th that left more than 1,000 Israelis dead. This is them returning to kind of their swashbuckling reputation. Hezbollah, that is Hamas's more powerful ally and part of the governing structure in Lebanon, has already said there will be a retaliation. But it's also possible that this will operationally hamper Hamas because he had really a very important day-to-day role. And with this killing a Hamas top leader in Beirut, it's a kind of James Bond success moment that is, I think, will have at least important symbolic effect.
Noga Tarnopolsky is an Israeli reporter based in Jerusalem. Noga, thank you so much, as always.
Thank you.
Japan is recovering from a major earthquake today. A video posted to social media shows the earth shaking violently at a shrine where people were gathered for prayers on New Year's Day. The earthquake struck the western side of Japan's largest island, Honshu. It's on the opposite coast from Tokyo. It was the most powerful seismic event to hit the country since the Fukushima disaster nearly 13 years ago. Rescue efforts are underway to free people trapped under the rubble. At least 50 people are dead, according to officials. The World's Asia correspondent Patrick Nguyen is following the story. Patrick, just how powerful was this quake, and what do we know about the damage that's been done?
It's a 7.5 magnitude quake, which is very powerful. A long 100-mile stretch of fault line shifted underground. And unfortunately, that happened right off the coast, off a prefecture called Ishikawa. So it did shake the villages and cities really hard. It split roads in half, it knocked down power lines, it started fires, and it created tsunami waves. I spoke to a seismologist at Cornell University named Judith Hubbard. She runs an online Substack newsletter called Earthquake Insights. And I asked her to compare this to Fukushima back in 2011, and she said the tsunami waves from this recent earthquake were up to about 6 feet high.
You know, it's a big wave, but it's nothing like the 2011 waves, which reached 40 meters high. 40 meters, it's like 120 feet. It's almost impossible to imagine what a wave like that looks like.
Patrick, with that huge wave, the death toll from that tsunami at Fukushima was also huge. Nearly 20,000 people were killed. How is this quake expected to compare?
Thankfully, it won't be nearly that high. It's at about 50 now. It might not climb too much higher than that. Dr. Hubbard, the seismologist, said that's not just luck. It has a lot to do with Japan's earthquake preparedness, which has gotten even better since Fukushima.
Japan is a shining light for the rest of the world about how to prepare for earthquakes. When I saw that this earthquake had happened, it didn't fill me with dread.
And she said, Carolyn, if this happened in, say, California, it would have caused instant dread because every seismologist knows California is not prepared and more people would have died. Whereas in Japan, many buildings are built on these things called vibration dampers, basically shock absorbers, so they can soak up the vibrations without toppling the structure.
Yeah, I've been reading a bit about how good Japanese seismic preparedness is in terms of construction. Can you tell me more about what Japan has done to improve its earthquake preparedness since that terrible Fukushima disaster?
Yeah, they've also installed a lot more seismic sensors since then, a lot more, and not just on land, but way deep out in the ocean. Japan now literally has thousands of sensors around its territory, and that's hundreds more than it had in 2011. So now when there's an underground rupture, certain things happen automatically. Trains stop, for one, and people get instant notifications on their phones. There's a Japanese woman who goes by the name Shiori online. She does live streaming, talking about video games and food. And she happened to be streaming on New Year's Day when the earthquake happened.
Whoa. Oh, that's a big one.
Earthquake. Earthquake.
Oh my God, it's big. I gotta go.
Earthquake.
So that's her phone sounding the alert, and people heard that sound all around the area from their phones, from their televisions, instantaneously. And in the end, she was totally fine, by the way. She went back to live streaming. But the idea is that people get advance notice so they can run to higher ground or take cover. In 2011, in Fukushima, there was a long delay of up to 30 minutes in some areas before the alerts started going out. And so officials later said that was not good enough. And they will be evaluating whether this expanded sensor network really helped to save lives during this earthquake on New Year's Day.
And one last thing, Patrick, what can you tell us about this commercial jet that collided with another plane in Tokyo today?
This is an unusual and somewhat related tragedy. A Japan Airlines jet full of more than 350 passengers collided near the runway of Haneda Airport, one of Tokyo's main airports, collided with a smaller propeller plane, a Coast Guard plane, which was involved in the rescue efforts. That small Coast Guard plane was apparently bound for the other side of the island where the earthquake hit. Most of the people on that small propeller plane were killed, five of them, with the exception, it seems, of the captain, who is in critical condition. Thankfully, everyone on the passenger jet was evacuated safely, even though that jet was consumed by giant flames. So overall, it's more jarring news in Japan, which is already struggling with the fallout of this earthquake.
The World's Patrick Nguyen is based in Bangkok. Thanks a lot, Patrick.
Thanks, Carolyn.
Coming right up, the photographer who captured South African apartheid for all to see. You are listening to The World. I'm I'm Carolyn Beeler. You're listening to The World. Peter Magubane revealed to the Globe what apartheid in South Africa actually looked like. The Black South African photojournalist documented life in the Black townships. He died yesterday at the age of 91. In one famous photo of his taken in Sharpeville, white police officers are milling around, seemingly ignoring the bodies of Black South Africans massacred by police earlier that same day. Peter Magubane was threatened, beaten, and imprisoned for his work. At one point, he spent 586 days in solitary confinement. Greg Marinovich is a fellow South African photojournalist who knew Magubane.
He was just such a nice guy, you know, low-key. And, you know, a lot of photojournalism is waiting and hanging around and stuff. And he was a great narrator of stories and historical things. He was wonderful.
Marinovich shot photos alongside Peter Magubane in South Africa. He described for us some of his most impactful work.
His pictures from the mine workers getting tested before going into employment at the mines. I think that work really stuck out. In South Africa, they needed a lot of labor. It was very labor intensive, gold mining primarily. And they would get miners in from South Africa, but also the neighboring countries. The mining companies got together to own an employment kind of agency, and people would have to go through tests in case they had silicosis or TB or whatever. And Peter's photograph of all these naked men with their hands up from the back, their hands up to be tested for medical problems. I mean, that really was just such a commoditization of people, and Peter captured it perfectly. And there's some famous pictures of, you know, Black nannies with white kids and the typical South African weirdness.
What truth did that tell from your perspective?
You know, white South Africans, the majority obviously I'm speaking about, were so racist and are so embedded in the culture that they were, on a religious point of view, God's chosen people. And on the other side, it was this fanatical obsession with race, and could a pencil stain your curly hair? If it fell out, okay, you weren't Black. Or, you know, all these ridiculous ways of understanding this weird concept of race and ethnicity. And so Magubane's pictures showing these people that they hated, these Black nannies, these domestic servants who were child carers, who raised the children of these white people that voted in a system that dehumanize those same people who are raising their children. I mean, it's insanity. It's ridiculous. And that was why those kind of photographs that Peter took were so telling of the system that helped explain what South Africa was about. And it's this intimate racism. It's not like racism through ignorance. It's racism through choosing to be racist. And that is what is so powerful.
Many of his pictures during the apartheid period were also published by a magazine called Drum. What can you tell me about that publication?
So Drum was an earlier South African magazine run by Bailey's. And it was really the first magazine to empower Black journalists and Black editors and Black photojournalists. And they did great investigative work. I mean, there's famous cases of a journalist going undercover onto a potato farm near Bethel, where he worked picking potatoes so that he could photograph and document what life was like as one of these laborers. And that was their approach. It was very gonzo journalism long before that term ever got made famous. And Magubane was like that. You know, he was hardcore. So often when Peter and I were working in some tense situation, those days of being a gonzo journalist would come back to him. And if cops or anyone tried to stop him taking photographs, he would get mad as hell. And he didn't take any crap from anyone. He would just tell them to take a running jump and carry on photographing.
And that was probably dangerous for him in that era, right?
So it was dangerous. But as you said in your intro, you know, the fact that he did 580-something days in solitary, not just in detention, in solitary, you either break or you toughen up immensely, and he toughened up immensely.
Mm. Peter Magubane was Black. You are white. What did that mean when it came to working as news photographers during the apartheid era?
So South Africa is pretty interesting. Black South Africans were amazingly sensitive to exactly who whites were, because they understood that, you know, the electorate was kind of 50-50 on who was voting for apartheid and who was voting against apartheid, and always the majority voted for apartheid, but it was close call amongst the whites, and especially amongst journalists, that there were a lot of whites who were very activist and anti-apartheid, and they would watch very carefully for all these signs. And so people were very accepting, and Peter was very accepting, but there was always this understanding that, you know, however sympathetic you are as a white person to apartheid's ills and what it did to black people, you weren't black and you didn't suffer from it. And so I think people like Peter Magubane and many of our peers, our black photojournalist peers, were incredibly generous in how they treated us, and the fact that they weren't perpetually angry with every white person, quite honestly.
And did Peter have, you know, any different or less access than a photographer like you, who was white during the apartheid era, in terms of how you went about doing your job?
So in the 1980s, black photographers had very good access to black communities, because whites were not allowed into black areas technically, and blacks weren't allowed into white areas without permission, you know, the old pass, the dorm pass system. Mm-hmm. And so the struggles of the 70s and the 80s were best documented by black photographers.
Now, after apartheid ended, what kind of work did he do after that?
He really wanted to do gentle stuff about his love for South Africa. So he did a lot of tourism style stuff. He did a lot of ethnographic work. That was mostly what he did.
It's nice that he felt able to do that at a point in his career, that maybe the apartheid documentation was ready to be over in his mind, or at least he had the ability to focus on something else.
Exactly. And, you know, I mean, I think for many people who'd been through that particular era, it was such a vindication of what you had chosen to stand up for.
Mm. You mentioned that Magubane's kind of fearlessness when he went about his work was something that stuck with you. Is there anything he ever said while on the job that has really remained with you to this day?
He didn't like to talk about what he'd sacrificed. He kept it to himself. People either knew or didn't know what he'd been through. And that was, you know, he didn't try and play a hero or something. He was very down to earth.
Greg Marinovich is a South African photojournalist and a master lecturer in journalism at Boston University these days. Greg, thank you so much for sharing your memories of Peter Magubane.
Thank you so much. And it's so good that he's recognized and his pictures will live with us for hundreds of years.
More news and stories from around the globe still ahead this hour. You're listening to The World. In Ghana, mixed opinions about Pope Francis's recent decision to allow same-sex couples to be blessed in church. Catholic bishops say they won't do it, but some parishioners don't see a problem.
At the end of the day, we are all supposed to be children of God. So if a priest is to bless same-sex marriage, there's no issue with it.
That's ahead on The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. You are listening to The World. We're a co-production of GBH in Boston and PRX. Fires burned across Kyiv again today after Russian missile attacks on the Ukrainian capital, another day in an unprecedented barrage of missiles over this holiday weekend. Stacey Pettyjohn has been following this. She's a senior fellow and director of the defense program at Center for New American Security. Stacey, how do these recent attacks we've been seeing over the past several days compare to what Kyiv has gotten used to during these almost 2 years of war with Russia?
Well, as you mentioned, these are unprecedented. This is of a scale that they haven't seen at all. Over 150 missiles were launched, including some of the kamikaze drones that the Russians have been using. This clearly indicates that there is an uptick in the Russian campaign against Ukraine cities, potentially going after critical infrastructure such as energy and electricity again, like they did last winter.
You mentioned kamikaze drones or missiles. What other kinds of missiles is Russia using?
Russia fired, at least in the December 29th attack, which there have been more details published about, a lot of its cruise missiles, its KH-101s, and the vast majority were actually intercepted by Ukrainian air defenses. But it's sending these complex, heterogeneous salvos that are very large and make it really difficult for Ukrainian air defenses to manage all of these different types of threats at the same time. So there are cruise missiles, ballistic missiles, some of the hypersonic missiles, the Kinzhals, just a handful of those, in addition to the slow-flying Shahed drones. And this just presents a threat that is very difficult to deal with.
And so is this approach, this sending of lots of different types of missiles and drones, is that a new strategy here?
No, it's not. If you look across the last few years, Russia has learned as its missile inventory has dwindled, especially its high-end missiles, its ballistic missiles, its hypersonic missiles, and even some of its cruise missiles, it was relying on the Shaheds just to keep the pressure up. But it has evolved over time, and it has used these kamikaze drones as enablers for these larger strikes. They're not only one piece of it, but they're fired by themselves to try to understand where Ukrainian air defenses are and to find weak points. This has been going on for a while, and Russia's gotten better at it. Ukraine's air defenses have also gotten better at intercepting these attacks. But at a certain point, when you have these very large numbers fired at the same time, it's going to overwhelm the defenses.
Yeah, the Ukrainian Interior Ministry said that the attack today killed 5 civilians and injured 125 people in Kyiv and Kharkiv. You said that the anti-missile defenses have been overwhelmed. Can you talk more about that?
I mean, this is really a one-for-one battle and sort of one of endurance that they've been fighting against each other, where Russia's trying to use some of these really cheap systems like the Shaheds to bait Ukraine into firing one of their expensive air defense interceptors at it so that they can then have an ability to fire other attacks, you know, at their will.
But even when Ukraine's anti-missile defense systems are successful and shoot things out of the air, those missiles and drones, you know, that material still drops somewhere. How likely are civilians to be hurt when those missiles are shot down?
They could absolutely end up dealing with the wreckage or the shrapnel that comes out. So it just sort of depends where they would land. It's certainly dangerous either way, even if they are intercepted.
Now, Ukraine has sent attack drones into Russia and for the first time taken credit right away. Can you talk about Ukraine's offensive capabilities right now?
Yeah, this is really interesting. Unlike Russia, which had long-range attack options from the beginning and had ballistic and cruise missiles that they quickly expended, Ukraine didn't have an ability to strike deep in Russia. And they have built this kamikaze drone program, and this has provided them with a limited ability to launch some strikes deeper into Russian cities and against Russian air bases. But while Ukraine has developed a really novel sort of capability that they wouldn't have if they didn't have these cheap kamikaze drones, my guess is their inventories are much smaller than what Russia has developed, and that it's much more limited capability that they have. So they're going to have trouble matching them one for one.
We said that the past few days of missile attacks are unprecedented. Can you anticipate at all what happens next?
If I were to guess, what's going to happen next is you're going to see a repeat, but perhaps an even more difficult winter for Ukraine in terms of strikes on cities and critical infrastructure. Russia knows that at this time, you know, when it's cold, taking out heat and energy, that it will have a disproportionate effect. And the hope is that they can diminish the Ukrainian people's will to keep fighting. And even if they don't succeed at doing that, they're going to divert valuable military resources, some of these air defense systems, from the front lines and from other military targets, and force them to be positioned around cities to try to protect the Ukrainian civilian population.
Not an optimistic picture as Ukraine heads deeper into winter. Stacey Petitjean is a senior fellow and director of the Defense Program at the Center for New American Security. She was updating us on Russia's military strikes on Ukrainian cities that have been stepped up in recent days. Thank you.
Thank you.
Pope Francis made a declaration in December allowing Catholic priests to offer blessings for same-sex couples. This sort of thing never would have happened under the previous pope, Benedict XVI, that according to his closest aide, Cardinal Gerhard Mueller. He spoke to reporters on Sunday, the first anniversary of Benedict's death.
There is no homosexual matrimony, doesn't exist, cannot exist, in spite of all the running ideologies we have. But what is true, it remains true.
Some of the 265 million Catholics in Africa also disapprove of the Pope's declaration. Many countries there have laws that criminalize homosexuality, and in some cases, offenders can face the death penalty. Bishops in Malawi, Zambia, and Nigeria have distanced themselves from the Pope's announcement. They say they will ban priests from administering blessings for same-sex couples. That is also the case in Ghana, West Africa, as Ridwan Karim Dinias reports.
Inside a Catholic church in Accra, the air is filled with the scent of burning incense and candles as the congregation sings. They are seated on polished wooden benches holding their hymn books. At the front row is Yurik Abuchi, dressed in a pristine white robe, singing.
Jesus, Lord, I ask for mercy, let me know.
Abuchi has been a Catholic all his life, and he says he disagrees with the Pope's recent declaration. He says it goes against the Bible.
When the people of Sodom and Gomorrah, they sin against God, and one of the things that they were doing was the same-sex issues. That was why God was angry and destroyed the whole city. So how come now we will decide that we have to do the same thing? No.
Yurik is not alone in feeling this way. The leadership of the Catholic Church in Ghana says inclusion doesn't mean discarding traditional teachings on marriage. Bishop Joseph Osebonsu is with the Catholic Bishops' Conference of Ghana.
Inclusion means that we welcome all manner of people to the church. And so people are welcome to come into the church, but if they are gays, the church cannot marry them.
Bonsu says this is because the suggestion by the Pope has no place in how God says marriage should be.
The church is against same-sex marriage. Christian marriage is a marriage between a man and a woman, and that a man cannot marry a man, a woman cannot marry a woman.
Men in Ghana perceived as gay are often harassed, beaten, and sometimes stripped naked on videos that are shared on social media. The Catholic Bishops' Conference of Ghana has supported proposed anti-LGBTQ legislation that would make identifying as gay punishable with a 3-year prison sentence and require conversion therapy. Gay rights advocates could face up to 10 years in jail, and citizens would be required to report anyone they suspect of being gay. But one of Ghana's leading cardinals does not agree with the criminalization of homosexuality. Cardinal Peter Apiatexan spoke to the BBC.
My position has simply been this, that LGBT gay people may not be criminalized because they've committed no crime.
He says that there have always been LGBTQ people in Africa, and people need to be educated about that. Genevieve Partington is country director for the human rights organization Amnesty International. She says Cardinal Texan is right.
Then I hope other clergy can learn from him. You need to define what a crime is. And normally defining a crime would have to do with physical assault, would be harming another person. And I don't see how somebody's identity is harming another person.
And there are some Catholics in Ghana who agree. Magdalene Senyo is one of them.
At the end of the day, we are all supposed to be children of God. So if a priest is to bless same-sex marriage, there's no issue with it. What is most important is everybody having a relationship with God.
This perspective is not common, though. A 2021 study found that 93% of people in Ghana would not wish to have people who are LGBTQ+ as their neighbors. This leaves a lot of people in the LGBTQ community doubting that the Pope's declaration will change anything.
No, no, nothing is going to change. No.
Thus, Michael, a gay man in Accra, who wishes to be identified only by his first name out of concern for his own safety. After the Pope's declaration, there was a lot of hate speech on social media. Michael says it left him very depressed. He says he hopes that soon the country will understand that when it comes to matters of the heart, love surpasses societal norms.
Love conquers everything, you know. Love knows no gender or whatsoever. Love is love.
For the world, I am Ridwan Karim Dini Osman in Accra, Ghana.
Nobel Peace Prize winner Mohamed Yunus is looking at a sentence of 6 months in jail. A court in Bangladesh yesterday convicted Yunus of breaking labor laws. He denies any wrongdoing. Mohamed Yunus is an 83-year-old economist who was recognized in 2006 by the Nobel Committee for his efforts to raise people out of poverty through small loans. He's a pioneer of the concept known as microfinancing.
And microcredit in Bangladesh is almost a household thing for every family in Bangladesh and the poor families.
That's Mohamed Yunus speaking with The World back in October. To learn more about his situation now, we're joined by Ali Riaz, professor at Illinois State University. Ali, we heard Yunus say there that microcredits are a household thing in Bangladesh. Tell us more about who he is. Is he a household name in Bangladesh?
Professor Yunus is well-known and pretty much a household name in Bangladesh. The bank he founded, called Grameen Bank, has extended loans to millions of Bangladeshis, particularly to women who were previously completely ignored in the market economy. That has empowered millions of women over the years, and it has been extended since then. Not only in Bangladesh, it has gone beyond Bangladesh in many places.
A familiar name and a lauded one, but now he's been convicted on labor law violations. What are the charges exactly?
There are two issues that they have brought up. One is that some of the employees who were contracted in the Grameen Telecom, this is the telephone part that he introduced a long time ago. It is a non-profit organization. It was said that 101 workers were not made permanent, which they claim that they should have been. And also there is an allegation or charge that the profit, which is reserved for workers, which should have gone to the individual workers, was put into the funds. And again, these are the allegations, and there are a few others, but most important thing are these.
Now, Yunus denies any wrongdoing, and one of his lawyers is quoted as saying the sole aim of this case is to harass and humiliate him in front of the world. Who are they arguing is responsible for that harassing and humiliating?
The government, especially Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina, has been saying things which are very unkind to Professor Yunus. At one point, Prime Minister Hasina actually said that Professor Yunus should be dunked twice in the river called Padma, where there is a huge bridge that has been constructed under Sheikh Hasina's regime. So this is why, apparently, the government is behind this, despite the fact that the courts do claim that they are independent, but there are allegations and understanding that in Bangladesh, judiciary has been compromised in many ways.
So the claim by the lawyers and Yunus is that Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina is behind this. Now, more than 100 global leaders and Nobel laureates wrote an open letter urging Bangladesh to shut down these legal cases against Yunus back in August. They also said they were deeply concerned about the health of democracy in Bangladesh. Why is that? Why the concern about the health of democracy?
The concern with respect to democracy is quite valid, because Bangladesh is moving towards a one-party system. The freedom of expression is dwindled. And these are the things that actually raises concern not only among the global leaders, it is a concern of the Bangladeshi people.
And then beyond this particular case, what's next for Yunus and his nonprofits in Bangladesh?
Insofar as his nonprofits are concerned, if you recall the Grameen Bank, which was the one, the basic institution that he founded. He has been pushed out of it years ago. The case that we are talking about is not about Grameen Bank. It is about the Grameen Telecom, which is engaged in telephone business largely. But this is not about this organization. It is in large measure about the person, Professor Mohamed Yunus, and his standing within the global arena.
We've been speaking with Ali Riaz. He's a distinguished professor at Illinois State University. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you.
2024 has arrived, and in case you haven't noticed yet, it's an election year in the U.S. The first votes of the presidential primaries are happening later this month. And here's something that caught our eye. More Americans are saying that foreign policy should be a top focus for the U.S. government this year. That's according to a poll from the Associated Press NORC Center. Pollsters asked U.S. adults an open-ended question about what issues the government should be focused on. 4 in 10 people offered up foreign policy topics. That's twice as many as those answering the same question a year ago. Immigration and the war in Ukraine were partly driving those answers. AP finds the war between Israel and Hamas is also driving public anxiety. But the single issue overshadowing everything else is a familiar one: the economy. Coming up, one Palestinian musician shares how people who live far from their homeland stay connected through music. You're listening to The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. This is The World. For the Palestinian diaspora scattered across the globe, staying connected to an ancestral home and making sense of what goes on there has long been a challenge. And that was even before the events of this past fall. Clarissa Batar is a Palestinian American who's found a musical instrument that helps make those connections. Batar spoke with Maklit Hedero, host of a podcast about music and migration called Movement. Maklit takes it from here.
As an immigrant kid, when you get interested in your parents' or your family's culture, you never quite know what it's going to bring up or how they're going to react. For Clarissa Batar, the first reaction was, well, skepticism.
I remember when I called my dad and I was like, I'm learning Oud. And he was like, Baba, it's difficult. You know, he kind of like, he put me down a little bit in a way that was a challenge to me. Because I was like, okay, dad, I'm going to show you. I'm going to show you that I can do this. The time was not something I even noticed, to be honest, of how much I was putting in. Like 1 hour would turn to 2 hours, would turn to 3 hours, and I would be sitting there for 5 hours and not realize. They used to laugh. I was in my freshman dorm room. They'd be like, I don't know, there's this person, they're always playing this Persian music. Then it wasn't Persian music, but I could hear them in the hallways saying that. They were very confused as to why this person was always playing this instrument. They heard it all the time.
Clarissa grew up in L.A., part of a well-established Palestinian community. One side of the family was expelled from their home in 1948, the other side in 1967. Clarissa grew up with stories of home and songs of home, but the Oud would help them connect with that past in a whole new way. One weekend, Clarissa came home from college at UC Santa Barbara, and they brought the Oud with them.
And I remember playing for my grandparents, and they were so shocked. And they were like, how did you know this song? And how are you playing so well? And it kind of brought the family together in a different way. Mm. We always had this love for music, but almost like resurfaced it. You know, growing up, my grandparents were my next door neighbors.
Oh.
My grandfather, he loved to sing a lot, so he, like, exposed me to a lot of music. I would sit in his car, and we would go for drives or, like, go to the grocery store, and he would just have all these classic Muhammad Abdul Wahab, like, very Umm Kulthum Tarab stuff. Growing up, I didn't realize how much it was, like, absorbing in my soundscape.
Mm-hmm.
But after I started learning Oud and putting that to practice, I realized, like, wow, even though I grew up in diaspora, I was still so surrounded by all of that music that it really helped me bridge that gap, like, to learn Oud and to have this repertoire, like, in my head, you know?
you were describing the car rides, I was thinking about, oh, okay, it's LA, Southern California, so the windows are down.
Definitely.
And I was like, is the music bumping? Like, is it like, was it like loud? Could you like hear it as you were driving by? Like, what's the...
Definitely. This is the type of music that when he was, you know, my age, it was the popular music at the time. And it's not the type of crowd where you sit and you listen silently to the music and you're like, you know, that was great. No, these people are like, if they hear something they like, they're standing up and yelling, Allah, and like screaming at the artists and telling like, my eyes, oh my God, this is so beautiful, and like screaming at them in Arabic. And so it's active listening. It's not just like a passive thing, right?
Right. I'm hearing you talk about how the Oud is bringing you closer to your family. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about whether it brought you closer to Palestinian culture as a whole, or like how that functioned like culturally or in the community.
There's just this constant grieving that happens as Palestinians, where you are just, you wake up to depressing news all the time. And it can be emotionally really tough. And I think that music and art provides like not only a way to communicate your pain, but also to have like spaces to heal. And this is somebody, I'm speaking as like with privilege as somebody in diaspora, you know? So I don't live under occupation on a regular basis, and it's taxing to have to see what your people go through. So you can understand like how important art and culture can be in these movements to help heal people and to like, you know, give people a way to cope with their reality. And even for me, you know, it's been layered too as a queer person, because I can even be othered within my own community.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's interesting to see how even the Oud has provided me a space to almost help my queerness become more palatable to my community in a way. Like I can participate regardless of that, and see, I've like seen my value, and I think that it's helped me a lot personally.
Clarissa still lives next door to their grandmother, though their grandfather has since passed away. Now for the two of them, those same songs and scales are layered with a new memory, the memory of that time when music brought the family closer together.
I think after my grandfather passed, it began to trigger a much more emotional response from her. But you can still see, like, between the tears, like, so much pride. Like, she's so proud of me. And so you can see these two different emotions inside when I'm playing for her. It's sadness, but she's also so happy.
That's Oud player Clarissa Batar speaking with Makleet Hedero. Makleet hosts the podcast Movement, all about music and migration. It's produced by Ian Koss and supported by the National Geographic Society and Mellon Foundation. If you were back at the office today getting stuck in traffic on the way in, may have been a cold welcome to 2024. Tomorrow, we'll learn about commuters who face a particularly grueling kind of traffic jam, the long wait times at the U.S. border between San Diego and Tijuana.
It's crazy. 2 o'clock on, if you're not in line, you're going to be hours to get across.
Gridlock testing the patience of commuters who cross the border daily. Join us for that tomorrow on The World. We come to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. Thanks for starting your year with us. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Be good to each other out there and join us right back here tomorrow on The World.